In 1974, Raspberry Williams shot and killed a Waterloo man. This year, Governor Branstad granted Williams' request for commutation. This hour, when should a life sentence be reconsidered? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, as part of our summer series looking at corrections in Iowa, we consider requests for commutation and the newly started Innocence Project. My guests include the attorney who prosecuted Raspberry Williams, David Dutton. Also, Elizabeth Albright Battles of the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence, criminal defense attorney and co-founder of the Innocence Project of Iowa, Kent Simmons. We start with the Raspberry Williams case after this news. On a summer night back in 1974, Raspberry Williams shot and killed a Waterloo man over a $30 gambling debt. This year, Governor Terry Branstad granted Williams' request for commutation, and this makes him eligible for parole. This hour, we ask, when should a life sentence be reconsidered? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, as part of our summer series looking at corrections in Iowa, we consider requests for commutation. Later in the hour, a couple of related topics, the Skylark Project, also the Innocence Project we'll talk about. But first, commutation. That's a word most of us don't use every day or very often at all. A commutation reduces a life sentence to a term of years, and this makes an inmate, an offender, eligible for parole. Since 1947, there have been 226 commutations. Governor Herschel Lovelace, our governor from 1957 to 1961, granted the most commutation requests, 46 of them. Harold Hughes, governor from 1963 to 69, granted 39. But when we look at the past three governors, Vilsack, Culver, Branstad, we have just 13, including the case I just mentioned, Raspberry Williams. So it's become a more rare occurrence. At the same time, the population of offenders serving life in Iowa prisons without parole has risen dramatically. In 1983, just 162. Today, 639. But let's start with the Raspberry Williams case. To do that, in our Cedar Falls studio, David Dutton, former Blackhawk County attorney who prosecuted Raspberry Williams. He's now an attorney in private practice in Waterloo. Good afternoon to you, David Dutton.
Good afternoon.
Welcome back to our program. We'll get to the point that you now support the commutation that was granted by the governor. But let's go back to 1974. Tell us about the crime that you prosecuted Raspberry Williams for.
Thank you, Mr. Kiefer. The situation was, as you described, an argument over the payment of a debt of some sort. The two participants, Lester Given and Raspberry Williams, met outside a local tavern. The demand was made for the payment of the debt. It was refused. Raspberry Williams claimed that Mr. Given reached for his pocket and that Raspberry Williams then pulled his gun and shot Mr. Given in the head, killing him instantly. The crime was typical of the gun culture that existed at that time, where in certain areas it was presumed that everyone was carrying a weapon of some sort, mostly a handgun, so that if you crossed that person, you had to be prepared to protect yourself and take measures to protect your life. Mr. Williams was tried before a Blackhawk County jury, found guilty of first-degree murder, and given the mandatory sentence of life in prison.
Mm-hmm. Briefly, how did the defense make its case?
Well, the defense, again, attempted to show that Raspberry Williams was acting in his own defense, a self-defense situation. It turned out that Lester Given did not have a gun, nor was he attempting to assault Mr. Williams with a deadly weapon.
Raspberry Williams has been incarcerated here in Iowa in the meantime for nearly 39 years. You have been a supporter You were a supporter of his request for commutation. Why?
Well, this is the second attempt, as I remember it, by Raspberry Williams to have a commutation of his sentence. The first occasion, I deferred to the local county attorney, Tom Ferguson, to decide whether or not to concede that he should be considered. Law enforcement was not willing to give me the green light at that point in time. And so on the second occasion, and based upon the recommendation of the parole board and the rather selfless, heroic acts that Raspberry Williams had performed while in prison, it seemed to me that it was appropriate to join in his request for a commutation of his sentence. My concern has always been in these matters with public safety and whether or not public safety would be compromised in any way by the release of a person from a life sentence. In this case, it did not seem to be a concern, and so I did, in fact, join in his request.
A couple of points I want to follow up on. I don't know if you said heroic. First two prison incidents that Raspberry Williams was involved in that spoke for him, spoke to his in favor of his commutation. Can you briefly tell us what those incidents were about?
I only understand what was portrayed at the meeting before the governor, but on one occasion he intervened to protect a female guard who was being assaulted by some prisoners, and on the other occasion, he actually came to the rescue of some other guards who were also being held hostage. Not only were those acts of heroism personally, but put Raspberry Williams at personal risk for his own safety because of the inmate population and their reaction to his intervention on behalf of the guards.
Mm-hmm. So in addition to, as you said, judging whether Raspberry Williams is any sort of threat to society at large, these two weighed heavily on your mind.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's you have some experience here in thinking about the safety of a released inmate because, am I right in saying you prosecuted one of the most heinous killers in U.S. history, John Wayne Gacy?
That's correct. And it happened at about this same period of time Mr. Gacy was accused of attacking a young boy, and actually we found that he had hired a hitman to try to kill the complaining witness. He was sentenced to 10 years at Anamosa and later paroled from Anamosa to a western suburb near Chicago, where he then killed 33 young men and buried them under the crawl space between his house and garage. I remember that very distinctly, and it always weighs in my mind as to whether or not releasing a person who has committed the crime of murder will compromise public safety.
Mm-hmm. And as Raspberry Williams, like in this sense, John Wayne Gacy, a model prisoner while in prison.
He, in fact, established the first junior Chamber of Commerce unit in a penal institution in the country to show the type of leadership that he was capable of performing.
David Dutton is with us, if you just joined us, former Blackhawk County attorney. He prosecuted Raspberry Williams, who was granted a commutation by the governor earlier this year. I want to have you join us, our listeners. When should a life sentence be reconsidered? When should we as a society decide that a life sentence should be rethought? What if you sat on the parole board or were the governor? What factors would you put highest on your list? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, we're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining us now, along with David Dutton, is Jason Carlstrom in our Des Moines studio. Jason Carlstrom is the chair of the Iowa Board of Parole. Thank you very much for coming into our studio today, Jason Carlstrom.
Yes, well, thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Kiefer.
Good afternoon. You've been listening to my conversation with David Dutton thus far. The Iowa Board of Parole recommended, I understand, unanimously for Raspberry Williams' request for commutation. The governor granted that. Can I ask you what were the chief factors behind your recommendation, your unanimous recommendation?
Yes, the recommendation was unanimous after an investigation and an interview with Mr. Williams. A lot goes into our contemplation of what we should do after an interview and for commutation recommendation.
Can you tell us some of the things that go into it? What's on your list, for instance?
Yes, certainly. A lot of things go into it. The entire file goes into it. Certainly his institutional behavior goes into our decision. The primary consideration is public safety, mm-hmm. whether or not we believe that Mr. Williams or any commutation applicant would be safe if released. Certainly their whether they've had a change of behavior or a change in the way they think. The change in their outlook on life, and it appeared to me anyway that had occurred for Mr. Williams. Again, each board member determines the factors on their own. Mm-hmm. Each board member makes their own choice and considers the facts as they see them.
Who is on the board besides yourself, and how many board members are there? Who are these people?
There are five board members. Two of whom are full-time, myself and the vice chair, Doris Kelly, from Waterloo. And we, at the time, we had Nancy Boyd, who was a part-time board member. We also had a Mr. Thomas Phillips, who's a part-time board member, and Jim Felker.
Mm-hmm. So the process is as follows. The offender requests commutation. The board takes up this request. And as you said, after lengthy process of looking into the case, do you actually interview the person at length, the offender?
Yes, we did. I think the interview we had with Mr. Williams was every bit of an hour, perhaps longer. But we'd also had a full review of the file prior to the interview. Mm-hmm. We reviewed the prior interview from the 2005 application that Mr. Williams submitted, and all of the documents in that prior application as well as the latest.
Does the parole board decision in such cases have to be unanimous, or do you have some decisions that go on to the governor that are not unanimous?
Each board member makes their own decision. For what determines the response to our decision is whether or not, well, in part anyway, whether or not it's unanimous. But each board member's vote is individually reported. For a considered a positive recommendation from the Board of Parole by our administrative rules, it must be a unanimous decision. But even if we make a unanimous decision, the ultimate decision is up to the governor and not up to the board.
Mm-hmm. How can you say how often a unanimous decision, a recommendation from the board is approved by the governor? What are the chances that happens? Does he usually take these?
I can't say.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
How often the governor gets a unanimous positive recommendation on behalf of commutation. Since I've been on the board, there's only been one. But I understand also the governor has only commuted two prior life sentences in all of his terms as governor. So it is a very rare experience.
How many commutation requests do you get in a year, say?
Well, not very many, maybe a dozen or two. Right now we've been working through a backlog of about 65 that we will have heard by the end of the year, but that's from a couple of years of backlog.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any change in frequency and uptick at all?
No, not that I've seen.
When you work, and we heard from David Dutton, and weighing many of the same things I imagine the people on the Iowa Parole Board do, and chief among them, you know, is this person a danger to society? What for you are the biggest difficulties, the biggest challenges, the balance you are seeking the things you wrestle with most when making a decision like this?
Sure. Well, let me go back and supplement a little bit to my previous answer. And one of the primary things that we consider is the effect on victims. Every time this is brought up, victims are readdressed. They are re-familiarized with potentially old injuries that they just soon forget. Mm-hmm. Dealing with victims is very important, making sure that it is that they are taken care of.
Do you also, board members, also interview victims?
No, we do not interview victims. We do have victims. Victims of violent crime have the right to address the Board of Parole, and we offer that to all victims, registered victims.
David Dutton, go back to you in Cedar Falls, the former Blackhawk County attorney, prosecuted Brasbury Williams, now in support of his commutation. I understand you did speak with a victim in making your decision, the sister of the victim in this case, didn't you?
Yes, but I didn't do it at the time of the commutation. I did it at the time of the prosecution. Vanessa Given, the sister, came to me and spoke rather passionately about the need to have the fullest extent of the law applied to Brasbury Williams. And I still consider that many years later when this application came across my desk. Mm-hmm. It is a factor, but we have to remember that these crimes are crimes against the state. To a certain extent, certainly the victims and their families need to be heard, but the determination is really made on a broader scope than that. And you also have to remember that according to Chapter 902 of the Iowa Code, an inmate can only make an application for commutation once every 10 years. However, the director of the Board of Corrections can make an application at any time. So the frequency of these applications is governed by statute.
Jason Carlstrom, chair of the Iowa Board of Parole. Back to you. We started to talk about the biggest challenges. You mentioned victims there too. But what are the factors you wrestle with that potentially cause you sleepless nights?
Well, certainly victims is one of the primary concerns. Another of the primary concerns is that particularly with, I guess, specifically with regard to commutation applications, is that a jury has found a person guilty of a serious crime, of murder. It is a panel of people that we respect and whose decisions we respect. We kind of need to discuss what commutation isn't to help understand some of the primary challenges. And it is not a retrial of guilt. So we respect what the jury found, what the jury determined to be the facts. Then, of course, a judge whom we trust and respect very much imposed a sentence. And the sentence was based upon laws that were passed by legislative bodies that are representatives of the citizens of Iowa. So all of those things are very important. And a positive recommendation for commutation is in no way a retrial or a disregard of that history. So in order to find something that would suggest commutation is appropriate, we have to look at whether or not the changes since the crime and sentencing, whether or not there have been changes that are extraordinary enough to warrant consideration of a second chance.
In Brasbury Williams' case, Jason Carlstrom, what change did you see in that person from 1974 to 2013?
Well, certainly what appeared to be the case in our investigation, prior investigations and prior interviews, we considered the input of wardens, the Department of Corrections. We considered everything in the file, and very much of what we found in the file suggested that Mr. Williams was a man who had changed his belief system. He had a very strong anti-crime message that he gave to other inmates. He mentored other inmates. He mentored outside of the prison, addressed an anti-crime message outside of the prison. He did all of this not anticipating or what appeared to be to not anticipate commutation, but rather because he decided, apparently, while he was incarcerated, that crime was not going to pay. And he demonstrated that in a number of ways. Of course, the mentoring that I've already mentioned, some of the behavior that he exhibited with regard to hostage situation, other fights in prison. He always seemed to be on the side of protecting people and stopping the more criminal-like behavior.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, sir.
Well, I was going to say he also became educated. He's done a lot. He's done an extraordinary amount with his life while he's been incarcerated, in spite of the life no parole sentence.
What is his status now?
He is after the commutation. He is now sentenced to life with the possibility of parole.
Mm-hmm. So the next step possible for him?
Well, the next step that will start occurring: every inmate in Iowa that has a mandatory minimum that has already been served is entitled to annual reviews by the parole board. So Mr. Williams is now eligible to be reviewed by the parole board every year.
Mm-hmm. It would be hard for you, I imagine, to comment on the likelihood that he will walk free one day.
Well, right. The likelihood of whether or not he'll walk free depends on a lot of things, and not the least of which is the decision of multiple members of the Board of Parole.
Mm-hmm. Back to you, David Dutton. You have had other cases where commutation has been requested. You have personal experience that makes you hesitate in support of a commutation, don't you?
Well, I do. And during the almost 10 years that I was a prosecutor and thereafter when I prosecuted murder cases around the state, I became aware of the violent propensities of a number of people who were charged and convicted with murder. The whole concept of the gun culture, as I call it, certainly plays a part in the actions of the people that I confronted. But there are some people who killed people without any kind of provocation, and they were doing it for their own personal profit or vengeance. And those people I don't think merited my recommendation for commutation, and indeed I opposed it. Those people fall into very different classes in terms of the circumstances under which they committed their crime.
David Dutton, we've run out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming into our studio in Cedar Falls.
You're welcome.
David Dutton, former Black Hawk County attorney, Prosecutor Raspberry Williams. Also, many thanks to Jason Carlstrom, chair of the Iowa Board of Parole. Thank you for coming into our Des Moines studio this afternoon, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up in just a moment, as we continue our summer series looking at corrections in Iowa, we're going to talk about two different projects, one with Elizabeth Albright, Battles of the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence. We'll talk about something called the Skylark Project. Also, we'll talk with the co-founder of the Innocence Project of Iowa, Kent Simmons, when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, continuing a part of our summer series looking at corrections in Iowa. Today, in our first half hour, we're talking about commutation, requests for commutation. And this hour, we want to continue the overall umbrella question we're addressing this hour. When should a life sentence be reconsidered? If you sat on a parole board, if you were the governor, what factors would you put on your list to consider whether someone who has been issued, who is serving a life sentence, whether that sentence should be reconsidered? 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Post your opinion, your question on our Facebook page, or tweet us at IPR talk. Joining us this half hour, Elizabeth Albright Battles. She is the Skylark Project Director for the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence in our Des Moines studio. Liz Albright Battles, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Kent Simmons is with us by phone, co-founder of the Innocence Project of Iowa. He's a criminal defense attorney in private practice in Davenport. Kent Simmons, welcome to you.
Thank you.
If I could, before we talk about the respective projects that both of you are involved in, I want to go to our caller. Hal is joining us in Cedar Rapids, 1-866-780-9100. Hi, Hal.
Thank you, Ben. I'm interested in this issue because I've written to prisoners for many, many years, and I'd like to honor the memory of a very dear friend that I wrote to for 12 years while he was at Fort Madison, and he took his own life last Wednesday, and he was 35.
Mm-hmm. Where do you come down on in this question that we're trying to address this hour?
Well,
when and under what circumstances a life sentence should be reconsidered?
Exactly. I think there is an underside to the law. You know, the laws are considered sacred, but there are things done in the name of the law that are not right and not sacred. And I think one of the things done in the name of the law, well, first, the death penalty is something that should be abolished nationwide. Secondly, life in prison is a horrible sentence. I know that crimes were horrible, that called up the sentence, but the sentence that you will spend the rest of your life and never get out is horrible. And I think, and I've done this, I've written to former Governor Vilsack on a particular prisoner, and I said, you know, this was a crime of passion. Both people were drunk, the victim and the perpetrator. And Vilsack wrote back a good letter, and also the warden at Anamosa, Mr. Alt, wrote, and he said, Hal, you know, I understand what you're saying, but they should serve at least 25 years. I'd recommend to our state legislature that all lifers be given a chance after 25 years for a hearing, all 638 lifers in Iowa. Some probably will never get out. Some, like my friend, have died in prison. But I think the sentence itself is inhumane, no matter the crime. And I think it should be changed.
Thank you for your opinion, Hal in Cedar Rapids.
You're welcome.
Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. Before we perhaps go back to the phones, let's hear about the projects. Liz Albright Battles, Skylark Project Director of the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence. What is Skylark?
Well, Skylark Project, like you said, is part of the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and we offer services and support to survivors of domestic violence at the Iowa Correctional Institution for Women.
Okay. So perhaps we can best have you tell us about what this project involves by having telling us about a case. Sheila Schertz is a case that I believe fits sort of the prescription that the Skylark Project is looking for. Tell us about her case.
Sure. So Sheila's crime happened in 1981. She and her husband and three other men were convicted of murder and kidnapping. Sheila's participation in the crime happened under the coercion of her abusive husband. He'd abused her for many years, stalked her when she was at work and those kinds of things. And then during the crime itself, Sheila didn't know this crime was going to occur until it started happening, and she was terrified. And then her husband explicitly threatened her that she needed to do A, B, and C, or else he would have to kill her as well. And so in that crime, one man was murdered, another man was kidnapped and tortured by Sheila's husband and the other men, and then left for dead.
And this crime happened here in Iowa?
It did.
Where?
In the Davenport area.
Mm-hmm. She was found guilty of second-degree murder, first-degree kidnapping, sentenced to life in prison.
Mm-hmm.
So where does the Skylark Project come in? Why take up her case? She's no longer with us, I understand.
Correct. Sheila passed away about 6 months after she was released from prison after commutation.
Mm-hmm. Why take up her case?
Well, the Skylark Project, for a number of years, our folks have provided expert witness testimony in criminal cases, trying to help courts and juries understand how domestic violence changes a victim's thinking patterns, can alter her perceptions of safety and danger, and to complicate the idea of justice, that it's not a black and white issue, that you know, sometimes actions that look one way on their face, when you see them in the context of a person's life and experiences, have a completely different meaning.
Mm-hmm. And so this, what I hear you saying is, this speaks to the growth in our knowledge, our understanding of domestic violence, how that works on an individual.
Absolutely. For a long time, no one really knew what domestic violence was, and then people started understanding it a little bit better. And even today, our understanding of what it does to a person, how it changes their thinking, how trauma impacts a person, is evolving all the time.
And so the judicial system, in your view, is catching up in regarding the culpability of survivors?
Somewhat, very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Laws don't change very quickly. And the criminal code is not written for survivors. They're sort of a tag on at the end. Domestic violence is not a defense to a crime. That's not going to get anybody off the hook. But evidence of battering and its effects can be used in a trial to help describe motivation or illustrate why intent might be other than what the prosecution is saying it is. But it's still very challenging, in part because the sentencing structure is set up so that depending on the crime you're convicted of, there's no room for taking that context into account. There's no larger conversation of how this is complicated and nuanced.
How many commutation cases has the Skylark Project taken to date?
We have about 10 clients right now. They're with the Iowa law, a person can only apply if they have a life sentence once every 10 years. And so some of our applicants have already gotten a no and are waiting to reapply, and then others are still in the application process.
Liz Albright-Battles, Skylark Project Director at the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Let me turn to Kent Simmons, joining us by phone, co-founder of the Innocence Project of Iowa. You are also a criminal defense attorney in private practice here in Iowa. This is fairly new in Iowa, the Innocence Project of Iowa. What is the purpose of it?
Well, the purpose of the Innocence Project of Iowa is to, first of all, educate the public about the incidents of wrongful convictions. They do occur in Iowa. We don't get as much publicity out here. We don't get as much attention from the courts because we don't have the death penalty. Death penalty cases get a lot more publicity generally.
Remind us, Kent, briefly of some of the cases where we got it wrong, our courts got it wrong, our juries got it wrong.
Well, we have one that's going to trial here pretty soon in Des Moines, and we'll see if a jury got it wrong there, and that's the Flores case. I've had a couple of murder first degrees reversed, and the person has gone free, and evidence was found to be improper. And then after that, there was no evidence. So I think our courts, as Liz mentioned, the courts are catching up. The legal system is catching up. There's been a change in the culture in the whole country to the point where the public firmly believes now that innocent people do get convicted of crimes and do go to prison for them.
Mm-hmm. You say the Innocence Project of Iowa now has a case. What can you tell us about this case?
Well, strangely enough, we've been in business now since 2007. It's taken us a while to get our structure built up. We've reviewed a lot of cases. We have one that we are about to file, which will be the first official case that the Innocence Project puts its name on. It will be filed in a county court, and it will challenge a murder first degree conviction that was based on the state's theory of a shaken baby syndrome death.
Okay, and I understand the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern is involved in this. How so?
They're not involved in our case particularly. They are involved in a couple of very notorious cases in the Chicago area where they've made great advances. So they have been responsible for lending technical support to us just through learning how they have gone about attacking those convictions. We have a great deal of literature out there in the medical and legal literature today that calls into serious question the viability of the theories of shaken baby syndrome.
Okay. As far, you've been in existence, the Innocence Project of Iowa, about a half dozen years, as you mentioned. Where can we tighten up things? Where can we make sure people do not fall through who are innocent into guilt? Where do you see the biggest opportunities?
Well, unfortunately, there are a lot of causes for wrongful convictions, and they often, very often, are the result of eyewitness misidentification. They very, very often are the result of false confessions, which are coerced or induced by a promise of leniency. There's, of course, official misconduct in police and prosecutor misconduct. Unfortunately, because of the lack of funding, a lot of our wrongful convictions are the result of ineffective assistance of defense attorneys. We have public defenders who are totally overloaded in caseload, and defending a case in a jury trial is not a simple process. You need a lot of time and you need a lot of effort if you are going to succeed. Our public defenders just don't have the time to do that.
I believe you involve yourself with evidence, some of this evidence going back years, even decades. It's important that that's preserved. How can we do better there, in your opinion?
We need to do better in this state in developing an evidence preservation statute. We really have nothing in the legal sphere in this state that requires a prosecutor or a police department to hang on to physical evidence that might be tested later in a way it has not been tested before, or in a way that is better than the way it's been tested before. And that is one of the top priorities of the Innocence Network nationwide, is develop evidence preservation statutes in every state.
So we've been talking, Kent, most of this hour about commutation requests. Is this something separate than you? You're actually going back to declare innocence, right?
So, correct.
So
correct.
So this is something separate than commutation in your case?
Correct. And we do occasionally get requests for assistance with commutations. We refer that out to private attorneys. We are focused on wrongful convictions and innocence. That is our mission.
Mm-hmm. Liz Albright-Battles, let me ask you, how do we make a decision about who should be considered for commutation?
It's a very difficult decision. For us, we have criteria. We do multiple screenings with our clients to determine where it's appropriate for us to put our resources. So, for example, the Skylark Project looks at whether domestic violence is directly related to the crime, the level of violence, is it extreme, and how much time a person has served in the prison, which is a consideration that, like, the board and the governor will care very deeply about, as well as behavior at the institution or other indicators that this person is a low public safety risk. So on the nitty-gritty side of it, that's part of our screening criteria to figure out where we should be working.
Do you have a current client seeking commutation you can tell us a little bit about?
I do.
Okay. Can you share this person's full name? It's a woman who suffered domestic violence, didn't she?
Right. Mm-hmm. So Judy White's crime happened in 1979. She was involved in a murder-for-hire plot with her husband. He was a major conspirator with two others. And it was a crime that happened over a series of weeks. And during that time, Judy was aware that the plot existed, but she didn't always know when and where things would happen. And she never called the police.
Did she take part in the plot in any way?
Very minimally. She made a bad joke to a friend that was taken seriously. Mm-hmm. And then she was present when they were making some plans, not when they were making other plans.
How does domestic violence figure into the Judy White story?
Mm-hmm. Throughout her relationship with this man, Judy was abused by her husband. He isolated her and controlled nearly every aspect of her life. As the crime was continuing, he made threats to kill Judy's ex-husband. She asked him to stop the plot, and he said no. And just the violence that was happening in her life made her feel powerless. When someone has that degree of control over her body, it's hard for that victim to feel like she can exercise any kind of control over that abuser, that person, mm-hmm. to make them stop. Abusers are also very skilled at getting victims to doubt themselves, so that a victim of domestic violence will feel powerless, she'll feel worthless, and she'll feel like she won't be believed. And in Judy's case, in 1979, we were just starting as a nation to have a conversation at all about what is domestic violence, why is this happening. So even if she had called the police to say, my husband is hurting me, the police might not really have known what to do with that.
Mm-hmm. What is the status of Judy White's case right now? You're representing her, I understand.
Correct. She's with the Skylark Project. She has gone through her interview with the Board of Parole, and she's awaiting decision by the governor.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what was the Board of Parole's decision?
I'd rather not comment on that. That's their area. It was a very difficult process for every client who goes through the interview with the Board of Parole. They really work hard to dig into the meat of what's going on, why this person feels they deserve it. And our clients carry a huge amount of guilt and remorse. And so this experience of trying to say how sorry they are and how awful they feel while also saying that somehow they would like their case to be looked at differently is very challenging.
Now, Judy White's case is on the governor's desk for his decision after having had the parole board look at it. That's what I understand. Now, do you know when that the governor will make a ruling? A decision?
He'll have 90 days once he reaches, once the board sends him the file. As far as I know, the board hasn't sent the file yet. They're still working on getting all their ducks in a row to send that over.
Have your efforts been aimed at this point toward the parole board, or do you have contact with the governor at this point in the case?
Well, most of our work is with the client, helping her prepare her application, writing our own paper, our own brief to support her application, gathering letters of support, and then helping her prepare for interviews. So the interview with the Board of Parole, she'll have an interview with the governor's office. And so we're really trying to empower our clients and help them feel like they have a voice, like they are believed, and that other people will believe them too.
Mm-hmm. We have just a minute left. I want to go quickly back to Kent Simmons and ask you, Kent, how does Iowa stand with its Innocence Project in relation to other states and their Innocence Projects?
Well, unfortunately, we are all volunteers, and we all have a limited amount of time to devote to this. Even the students who work for us in the law schools and the School of Journalism in Iowa City do it on a volunteer basis. They don't even get any credit. We are hoping, we have always hoped, that one or both of the law schools in Iowa will essentially take over this project so that funding and workforce will no longer be a problem for us. But we're not going to quit, and we have been moving forward and making progress, and we intend to. I'd like to say anyone who wants to know more about us should check our website at www.iowainnocence.org. org.
Thank you, Kent Simmons. Contact information from you, Liz Albright-Battles, before we have to go.
The Iowa Coalition is at www.icadv.org. And the Domestic Violence Hotline statewide is 1-800-942-0333.
Liz and Kent, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Help from Tony Daner in Cedar Falls in Des Moines. Help from John Pemble. Joining me now in the studio, Charity Nebbe, a host of Talk of Iowa, tomorrow at 10 o'clock. What's in store for us, Charity?
Well, of course, we all have laptops, and a lot of us have tablets and smartphones that allows us to work anywhere,
It
anytime.
Follows us everywhere. Right. Oh, boy, does
so
it ever. Yeah.
It creates a lot of flexibility, but it also, of course, eats up a lot of our time, and it means that we're always connected. So we're going to talk about the changing workplace and how this technology has affected us in good ways and bad.
Ooh, sounds great. Talk of Iowa with Charity Nebbe. Thank you for coming in, Charity. 10 o'clock tomorrow, Talk of Iowa. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.